I'm Norma Everest, and I'm a professor at Wartburg Seminary in Dubuque, Iowa. I teach in the Division of Ministry, but this week I've been exploring with people here issues in American civil religion. I think it's terribly important that we understand the world in which we live if we're design a ministry in a public world. So I think they tie together. And yes.
I'm sorry, is the mic on?
No, but I'll talk louder. We're not using a mic for words, but I'll talk louder. Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Okay. I also believe our students at the seminary should learn to project, so they don't need a microphone. So tell me if I, as I say, I'm a little on the weak side, so if my voice gets weak, you let me know. I'm a couple more. All week we've been talking about American civil religion, and each of these sessions is somewhat connected, but each is an entity unto itself. So if you haven't been present at the others, there's no problem there. But this evening we're going to talk about what I consider a symbol of crisis, and that is the public school. And I'd like to develop a little bit for you how it is I think the public school is not just a place where there's plenty of crisis anyway, but also a symbol of crisis in American civil religion. Any newspaper you would pick up, any newspaper, has some issue, some news story on something that's going on in the public school. School busing, school prayer. Just last week before I came here, there was the news item about the Congress passing the bill that it had earlier rejected, and that was saying that the school building could be indeed a public place and a public meeting place for religious groups. Interesting that just a few months separated a yes and a no vote. That to me signaled the ambiguity that we feel. One could say that the issues of declining populations of small towns leading to closing of some schools, or infighting among politicians and public officials, or squabbles over the use of property, or decline in reading scores, or change in disciplinary attitudes, in child-rearing, all of those are enough issues in themselves to create concerns in any community. But I believe that the intensity of the emotion and the frequency with which the public school is the center of controversy indicates that the public school is more than a public school. I think that it is a symbol of the heart and hopes of our country. And I think it is the vehicle upon which this country depends to transmit its American civil religion. Now, by civil religion, we have been saying this week, we're talking about a term that Robert Bella coined in 1967 when he wrote that beside the established religions in this country, separate and distinct from, yet sometimes intermingled with, is an American civil religion, complete with its symbols, its rituals, its holy writ, its holy places. And some of you that have been in the Koinonia have seen on the wall some of the work we did earlier this week. Symbols, everything from the golden arches of McDonald's to the Lincoln Memorial. Holy days, certainly Memorial Day, 4th of July. Christmas is both a Christian holiday and American civil religion holiday. So is Easter. Easter bunny, symbol of one, and the cross and resurrection, symbol of the other. It is not just a religion in general, but indeed a civil religion. 8 years ago, at the time of this country's bicentennial, the public school was very much in the limelight, and probably some of you were involved in some of those issues. Often the community pageants were celebrated in the school auditorium, all of the bicentennial pageants. Meanwhile, in the school parking lots, there were busing controversies and teacher strikes. And both were going on, the celebration and the controversy, in what I think is a meeting place for many communities, and that is a public school. In many communities, there is no longer a town meeting hall, as there were in the New England communities for many years. Maybe there's a town park. Maybe the closest we really come to it is the mall, the shopping mall. But much of what we do there, we do anonymously and not really as a community. One time with one of my classes, I sent them out on a Tuesday afternoon to find where the community was or where it was gathered. Go looking for it. Some went to the library. Well, a few people there. But where is the center of a community? Often, in lieu of such meeting places, the public school auditorium is such a place. The country, just a few years before our bicentennial, seemed in doubt about its very survival, going through the controversy, the racial riots, the Vietnam War, Watergate, and then they threw themselves a party, or we threw ourselves a party. I don't think it was a coincidence that the celebration, the 4th of July in 1976, came on a Sunday. And there was a lot of intermingling of religious and patriotic events. But the very fact that much of this is centered in the public school raises questions about such things as, what is public? And the very issue before Congress last week raised that question. Is the public school a public meeting place? What is neighborhood? And I think even such questions as, whose is the child? The question, what is the role of the public school in the United States, leads to the connection between common education and the belief system in this country. What are the beliefs that we hold dear, that we hold in common and wish to pass on to the next generation? The ambiguity arises very early in this country, in our country's history, and yet, strangely enough, is never seen as ambiguity. In the beginning, and to some extent ever since, Americans have interpreted their history as having religious significance. We as Americans have seen ourselves as a chosen people, in the classical and biblical sense of the word, coming across the seas to the promised land, complete with American dream, the chosen people which are to lead, in some way, as a beacon and a light to the world, the salvation of the world. Now, whether or not each of us believes that, that belief system rather exists and is part of our bones, because many of us have grown up in this country. The country was often seen as God's gift to the world, yet with definite strains of having made it for ourselves, for its beginnings have a definite date and the result of conscious decisions. So it's like we're God's chosen people, but yet we pulled ourselves up by our bootstraps. Those kind of things together. The dream and myth of origin, by their nature, had to be complete and perfect without ambiguity, and even while the very activities of the Europeans who saw this as the promised land made the myth a lie. And you can see this particularly in two ways. We had no room in the American dream for the people that were already here when we came, the Native Americans, and we brought a whole continent of people over as slaves, and we never quite figured out how they fit in the American dream either. So we were a pluralistic people, but we never really faced the pluralism. We were a United States, we were a united people. And today, much of the advertising appeals to the American dream. What are the characteristics of the American dream, you see? Having so many cars, etc. Well, there are indeed varieties and differences in the dream, yet the values were common enough so that, beginning with the Puritans, they passed on to their heirs both the view of themselves and themselves as God's chosen people, destined to serve as example to the world, and in this sense of responsibility for the morals of society. And although each faith community has its own system of education, among Protestants in the 18th century, the churches together were charged with the responsibility for teaching the basic beliefs necessary for the welfare of the society. Well, Horace Mann, who is remembered really as a father of public education, while he was against sectarian indoctrination, accepted the assumption that basic tenets of Christianity and good citizenship were to be taught to the common people. So in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, where he began his work, he was against sectarian teaching, but it was fine to have religious teaching in the common school. And he really never solved the dilemma for himself or for that time of how you are to carry out inculcation of an American religion which is not specific. Such a blend of patriotism and piety, I think, is best exemplified in the McGuffey readers. And many of us did not have those. We had Dick and Jane of Scott Forsman. But the McGuffey readers blended this rather, they were really a Protestant textbook. And out of that milieu, the Catholic schools arose, due in fact, not because the public schools were humanist or secular, but because they were Protestant. A major reason for the great outcry against the Supreme Court decisions of 1962 and 63 prohibiting prayer and Bible reading was that it seemed to banish the generally accepted civil religion from the schools. Even though we say we have separation of church and state, we somehow hoped in the back of our mind, and here by we, I don't mean you and I individually, but as a people, we somehow hoped that we would be God's chosen people and we'd know about that, and who else could we carry on or expect to carry on that belief but the public school? The public school was also counted on to be the melting pot of immigrant children. And for many of us, it was a place to succeed, despite our background, economic or ethnic, if we were of the right color. It was a place where we could go in, no matter what our economic level, and come out and succeed. And the public school is a very precious thing to me. But I wonder if we have not expected of it too much. Well, if Bella is correct that American civil religion is in a time of trial, the very controversy, I think, is played out symbolically in the public school. So the loss of prayer, and that's very much still in the news, particularly with our current president, in the public school looms much larger than it is because the United States public and civil beliefs themselves are in question. I think it's a faith crisis. I think it's a faith crisis of our nation, and we expect the public school to solve it for us rather than individual faith communities doing their task. We have somehow freighted up the task of the public school to solve it for us, and we symbolically place the crisis there. It's no wonder teachers feel a burden. It's quite one task to teach, but also to be a place of the symbol of a crisis in a nation is really quite a bit. Okay, the issues, again, I think are many. The issue of prayer and Bible reading in public schools is a complex one. Even before we began to realize the problems and possibilities of pluralism, the distinctive tenets of the Judeo-Christian heritage, as recorded in the Old and New Testaments, had given way to the belief in the chosen nation, which had competition and commercialism as some of their basic tenets. So the faith itself, some of the tenets of American civil religion, be number one, succeed, are similar, but really, in some ways, quite different than the beliefs of Judaism or Christianity. Where is the suffering servant in American civil religion? It's not there. The confused and frenzied and sometimes very complex controversy, often magnified beyond all proportion, indicate that something much more is at stake than meets the eye. Had any of the advocates actually advocated restoration of school devotions, or the full understanding of the implications of allegiance to a suffering God whose will is to establish justice for the oppressed, had they reckoned with the issues of pluralism? The voluntary prayer and neutral silence seems to more aptly symbolize the quiet place most Americans would like for religion to have in their lives. So I think it's very interesting, particularly our current president, who says a moment of quiet would be very appropriate. Because we really don't want religion to be too specific, you see. American civil religion is an interesting faith. Okay. Just as Horace Mann wrestled with and never settled with what non-sectarian teaching could actually be, so non-denominational prayer, or sanitized prayer, some people say, had questionable religious value. Such prayers may even be objectionable, since they may promote a religious experience which conveys none of the substance, the depth, or the cutting edge, or the witness of any faith group, but is merely a non-denominational kind of non-entity prayer. One testimony before the U.S. House Judiciary Committee says, "We also object to non-denominational prayer, which may uncritically mix nationalism and religion. We believe that the purpose of prayer is to praise and petition God, not to serve the secular purpose of creating a moral or ethical atmosphere for public school children." And some of the quotes from Reagan are, somehow we have to save the nation by praying in public school. I think that's putting a lot of freight on our children, particularly if they're supposed to do it silently, as some people say. Okay, the issue of busing. I think the issue of busing is also an interesting one, and even though that's somewhat quiet right now, I don't think it is at all settled, but I think it is more than meets the eye. Whether or not busing is capable of achieving the goal of integration, and we could argue that for a great length of time. The very fact that busing continues to be an issue signifies, I believe, the battle is a symbol of unresolved self-identity as a nation of diverse people who confess they can live together but seem eternally unable to do so. The school is seen as the hope of melding the nation together while even neighborhoods refuse to mingle. The public school was a symbol of the melting pot. Indeed, education did provide second generations of many immigrant groups a way out of the ghetto, but only if their skins were white and their accent could be overcome. The public school lives on, and American civil religion is a great equalizer. In February 1982, the Senate voted to prohibit courts from ordering the busing of students more than 5 miles or 15 minutes from their homes. As in the prayer issue, one quickly realizes that the matter is not always just one of riding a school bus, because children all over this nation, you see the buses lined up now in August, ready to go. I mean, children ride hours and hours on buses, often unsafe buses, and that's a real issue. But it's not a matter of whether children ride buses or not. It's a matter of whether we think busing can help us come together as a pluralistic people. And again, busing seems to be the symbol of a greater problem of our whole society. Redlining, real estate, insurance, all of this kind of thing keeps peoples apart, and we think somehow that the public school ought to cure it. The inability of the country to achieve healthy pluralism is the issue. People continue to flee from the stranger. The failure to create community and the resulting guilt is again projected on the public school, the institution which is to be the provider of and bearer of the public faith. It is these basic assumptions and expectations which need to be examined and which go unexamined. What is the nature of education in the public arena? What is the goal of education? These unasked questions, combined with unrecognized and unresolved guilt on the part of the people who believe in the dream but have not been able to make it come true, continue to make these issues emotional ones. Well, we could go on. Let me just allude to a couple, and then I'd like for us to get into some discussion. The humanism and values clarification issue is another one. One of my students brought to me a pamphlet being passed out in her hometown. Is humanism molesting your child? Very powerful, emotional. Is humanism molesting? Because child molestation is a very serious issue, but the combination. And with this message, you see, you are supposed to see that humanism in the public school is a very dangerous thing. I think, again, that our country is in a crisis of values. Again, not realizing we are pluralistic people, assuming we should have common values. 10, 15, 20 years ago, values clarification became very popular in our schools. And many of you teach it or have been part of it. And I think it begs the question, is the public school a place for us to clarify values, or do some people expect them to inculcate values, abdicating our own responsibility as families and as faith communities? I think that the public school would be a place indeed to clarify and to share values, to come together as different people in a public space. But the fear around these issues, I think, is really very, very interesting. Other issues that we have in Iowa, and probably across the nation do as well, is should a family be able to educate their children at home? The whole rise in private schools, the whole issue of parochial schools, why do they exist, is an important question to ask. I think it begs the question of whose is the child? A while ago, there's a child, I don't know his name even, it was helping me arrange this up here, and that is my child. I don't know his name. He comes from one of your families, but that child is my child, and he and I belong to each other. Whether or not I educate my children at home, they are to come together in a public world. So the questions of whether or not I have a right to educate my children at home, and we have people blocking folks up for doing that, you know, jailing them for doing that, beg some very deep questions of whether we'll become more of a privatized people or whether we will be a community of faith communities able to come together and live together. Well, with that, let me stop and invite you to jump in here with one of my headlines that I put in this paper was Iowa officials brace for battle of creationism. And even though the creationists have forged the battle. The question belongs to all of us. What is the origin of this world and of humankind? How many views are there, and how many views should be taught in a pluralistic school? Maybe we can even coin that term, a pluralistic school. That's right. Some more. Yes.
I think I wasn't aware that evolution was a fact.
It's not.
I thought it was a model for thinking about how organisms change. Well, I consider that to be a mistake. It's a way of thinking.
Right.
It's a model. It's not a fact.
But it seems to be the only thing that's taught in the way that things are expressed that seems to come across, what I hear anyway, speaking, that it is the way. They always say, and this evolved into that, and evolution this. It's just, well, I think some programs like Nature, Public TV, and NOVA, there'll be statements by people.
Well, what we have here going on, I think, is an example of what we're talking about, isn't it? And that is some of us adults trying to define a word such as evolution. Is it a teaching process? It is a fact. And there's probably a lot more definitions. And then saying, how are we going to deal with this with our children? As they come to bigger, yeah, we're kind of acting out here that one important debate. Yes. If you could talk a little louder, because we have competition from below.
As a student in high school in Sacramento, I felt a little frustration because I wanted to bring out a speaker about El Salvador. And I was talking to my multicultural studies teacher, and he was real, he sort of listened to me, but he was kind of discouraging, saying how the administration really doesn't like any controversy on the campus. And I get real frustrated, and that there can be no dialogue, there can be no, everything has to be super neutral, otherwise the parents will get outraged.
I think that that's an example of what I've been saying, that I think, I don't at this time teach in a public school, I've worked in public schools, so that I know the kind of fear that is there. Let's keep it calm, let's keep it neutral. Because these issues are very controversial on either side. Go ahead.
I was also involved in another controversial thing in our high school. I was part of a group of students who organized a Bible club on our campus. And it,
were you allowed to be on the property?
Yeah, we were unofficial for a while, and then
Well, yeah, and I think it varies a bit in various parts of the country. Just if, for example, an area is almost entirely Christian, they may indeed sing Christmas carols and etc., and the intermingling of the public school and the community as expression becomes kind of one. In other places where there are more different types of people, more different faiths, but it isn't. Whether it's easier or harder isn't the question. Like, the question remains, and it's a national question, of what is the purpose and what is the place and what is the role of the public school. Somebody over here had a hand.
If they can study the other religions in the school, like in the library, why can't they have a Bible in the school library?
Most public school libraries have a Bible.
Go ahead.
Well, doesn't the Supreme Court decision allowing for the teaching of religion in the public schools, but the public schools have generally not taken advantage of that. I remember when the National Council of Churches, their religious education arm, prepared a whole raft of, quite a large bibliography on curricula for the teaching of religion in the schools, teaching about religion. As far as I know, there aren't very many schools that are doing it today.
There has arisen in our country, and I worked on it when I was in Connecticut, I worked extensively on this with the Religious Education Association, what we call religions studies, instead of religious studies, religions studies, which is the, well, I'd hate to use the word objective, but let's say the objective or the study about religions. Let me say two things. I'll say something about that first. The very fact that there are people of faith and it makes a difference in their lives is part of the history of humankind. And so for us to say separation of church and state or religion out of the schools means we ignore the fact that people are influenced by and are religious is to deny part of their history and part of reality. Now, how do you talk about that? And if you merely talk about it, is it become kind of too, again, sanitized, too objective? Another side of the question is, even if you have a public school classroom in which you do not pray or do not have reading of the Bible or whatever, do you have a value-free classroom? Do you have a religion-free classroom? People believe. Even when we talk about this little debate here about evolution, we have belief systems. And they're often unexamined if we say we're not going to talk about them because they exist anyway. Santa Claus is in most public schools. Huh? And the American civil religion doctrine of Santa Claus is if you are good, you will get presents. Well, now that is a faith stance, isn't it? I think it would be more healthy, and I'm showing my hand here, if indeed we were allowed to come to a public meeting place, whether we are children coming to a public school or adults coming to a public forum, as people of faith, able to talk out of our faith stance and growing in skills of listening to one another. That's not easy. And then you can say, well, with the small child who is very influenced by that third grade teacher, you know, shouldn't that teacher be neutral? And I know in many teachers' meetings about this time of year, new teachers are told by their principals, do not let it be known what faith you are. Maybe some of you have been told that. Well, does that mean I'm supposed to hide the fact I'm a person of faith? Tricky questions. Let's hear from some more of you. Yes.
I guess my own opinion is that there are certainly a lot of difficulties with our school system, but at least for myself, I would certainly want to encourage us as Christians to be involved in our school system. They are still the basic means by which the majority of so-called minority, but that are actually the majority of people of the world are educated, will be educated in this country for years down the road. They are the majority place where the poor people of our country will be educated. Our private schools will never take care of the avalanche of children. And so I hope as Christians, whatever we're going to be doing, and in spite of the fact that it's a mixed bag, that we would want to hang in there and try to support many, I think, dedicated teachers who have given their lives and continue to give their lives. And it seems like to me that what I hear the Christian community often doing is becoming very critical over the public schools on one or two issues, and boy, you can sure play that banjo a long time if you want to. But the fact of the matter is that is the only means by which this country is going to educate the vast majority of children. And for no other reason, these, especially we should want to do it because of the poor children of our country and of minorities, so-called minority children, who are going to be there. We are not going to do anything in the church to give these people a chance to be educated in our country, no matter what prayer or whatever else we're going to say. I think we should hang in there as Christians and support the public school system, in spite of the fact that it's a mixed bag, and continue to be a mixed bag.
Do any of you live in New England now? We did for 9 years, and it was fascinating to me, coming from Iowa, which has a high commitment to public education in dollars and in history and whatever. In New England, our children, when they would do well in school, would be told by the teacher, well, your child is doing so well, you will no doubt want to put him in a private school. And I'd say, no, I want to have him in the public school and to be educated well. Well, we weren't communicating. It took me a few years to figure out and to learn my history that, of course, private schools preceded public schools in New England in a longer history, and that I had to learn that was a frame of mind. But I continued. We lived in inner city. Our kids were the only white kids among all black and Puerto Rican kids all their grade school years. I continued to say, I want our children to be educated together because this is a country we're going to live together in a public way. And I'm grateful that for that experience. It is not easy. And I think it behooves us to work together as adults to carry out these dialogues, to struggle to make it work. There are some varying options put forth by people today, and one is separate schooling for differing groups in our country. And the voucher system is one way that some advocates have of pulling that off. And that's interesting. The extent of that, how far that would go, might indeed have us quite privatized. Another is that the assumption, number two, is the assumption that religion is separable from education, that people as they think, speak, write, should not act publicly as people of faith, but should come together in neutral ways. I don't think that's possible. Or if it is, we will have more and more of a secular society in which our faith will need to be invisible even to ourselves. If we assume that we are to leave our faith behind closed doors somewhere and not know what other faith someone is. But there is a, there's a kind of, well, some people think that's the option we should take. And even on TV, the only clergy people you see on TV are Father McKay, or, you know, there's a kind of joke about them or whatever. And church is some place you go if you have no other place to go, or, you know, whatever. Three is the establishment of religious schools, assuming enough commonality, maybe the American civil religion, to be able to utilize public religious school as a vehicle to teach morals, values, and worldviews. Newfoundland, any of you from Newfoundland? I can talk about, no. Newfoundland is interesting. Just about 10 or 12 years ago, decided to have their public schools be religious schools. So they're not coming out of a long history, but that's a present-day decision. And some of their science teachers were the first ones to volunteer to teach religion, which was interesting. But they decided to put it together and to have their public schools be religious schools. I don't think that option is going to be one Americans are going to claim. We are too diverse for that. Neither am I advocating it, but it's one option. The fourth is the acknowledgement that people are incurably religious. We all do have a faith stance, and it's helpful for us to know what that is, so it is not just a kind of unexamined faith. That people of faith act on those beliefs, and that every institution teaches a theological or at least philosophical worldview, and to examine that and to figure out how we can be people of differing faiths who come together in a public place for the public good, so that all children will be educated. It is not enough that my children be sent to private school because they're smart or something, and they'll succeed. Huh? My children's welfare depends on the education of all of the children in the land. And it does no good for some to succeed, some to have better schools, at the expense of others. It really, well, we have seen in our country what that has done. For this country, and I love my country, for this country to be its very best is for all of the people to have the very best education they can. Well, I'm showing my hand more than I should. Let's hear from you.
Two things.
Please.
One is that one of the arguments for the voucher system is that there's no real good reason why the government should have a monopoly in education. And that free enterprise in education just maybe ain't such an awful bad idea. Especially given, and this is my second point, given some of the consequences of private Christian schools in inner city areas, where the private Christian schools have, I think of particularly private Lutheran schools in Detroit, and Brooklyn, and Los Angeles, private Christian schools, Lutheran schools, have become model schools and have actually helped improve the quality of public education because of the competition. I really believe that government monopoly of education has served America very, very poorly.
It's interesting, the choice of words. Again, from my own experience, before we lived in New England, we lived in Detroit, and we were in a parish which had a Lutheran school, and we were in the inner city, and the very thing you describe is what we lived for 5 years, and I think we served well that community. I think, once again, one must ask why one has a Lutheran school. Is it to escape people of other colors, or so that our children would be safe from them? I'm not saying you're saying that. I'm just raising the question.
Oh, well, that school that you, yeah. Where you were, that certainly wasn't.
No, it was so that maybe in a smaller way you could concentrate and have a mission of educating some so that the general welfare would be improved. And we were active in the community. So I come out of ministry experiences both ways. With Lutheran schools, well, before that I was in St. Louis and we had a Lutheran school. Before that I was in Iowa where we had public schools. So I've had really four or five different experiences. And those questions, I think, are important ones. The choice of words, though, when you say the government I have a monopoly on, one way is to word it that way. Another way is to word it the people educating their children. The word government sounds like an outside force, doesn't it? At the same time, and here again, one of the values of American civil religion is free enterprise system. Very strong. With that, however, is that some will succeed and some will, you know, you'll have difference of quality of product. Competition, I think, does help raise your quality of product. It also means that some are at the bottom, or does it?
I wonder if it's because many times we have legislators making educational decisions without educational input, and so we begin to think the government.
I know some of you are teachers. Do you feel like you have a voice in the school system in which you teach?
Yes.
Okay. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, very little of the money for schools comes from the federal government. I know it's a lot less than 10%. Most of our money, at least from Washington, comes from local levies. And I don't think of it as them money. It's a local school board. And I don't know. The idea of competition, I'm not so sure that's always that healthy. What do you base your judgment on? How well they do on the CTBS tests, you know, and then you begin to teach to a test. Yes. And do you allow for different teacher styles? You know, I've taught with many different people, and some of them teach differently than I, and I think they are very good teachers. I'm not saying that we don't need change and we don't need improvement, but I really feel that there's a lot of good out there, and that we don't need to always focus in on how bad the system is. I think there's a lot of good stuff out there. I can say of the people I work with, all of them are very outgoing Christians, and they don't mind making, that isn't something that they're afraid to talk to their students about.
That's interesting. It'd be fun if we could just kind of take the time and hear, I mean, all the different communities in which we come, to have all those experiences together here would be very, very interesting. Do any of you live in communities where either after or during the late 60s, early 70s, there was a phenomenon in which many people pulled their kids out of the public school and organized, quote, Christian schools or private schools so that public schools just became for, okay?
I live in Los Angeles, and when busing first started there in certain areas of the city, which is very large, there was a large pullout of children into private more than Christian schools. Since busing has kind of been repealed in Los Angeles and they've gone to magnet schools and other kinds of things, some of those private schools have died and the children are back in the public schools.
How many of you come from communities with a magnet school system? In a sense, that raises up a little bit of the competitive possibility, huh, of which you speak, but still within the public system. You had your hand up a while ago.
Oh, well, when you mentioned, I got the feeling that if free enterprise or private enterprise had schools and there was competition, some would be better and some would be worse, but if the government, whoever has it, they're all the same.
Oh, and that's not true. Yeah, it's good.
What you pointed out is that they're funded very differently.
Yeah, that's true.
And there is not, so if there was competition or something and some were better and some were worse, that may not be too different than right now anyway.
Well, go ahead.
And if you're afraid of government, now the schools are run by local school boards, you go to the voucher system to get this competition, soon there's going to be a movement going to make sure that every school meets a certain standard. And that's where you're going to get government at a much higher level, state or federal level, making decisions as to what is the normal thing that these academies or private schools have to meet. And if they don't meet them, watch out what happens when the government steps in to try to close them because they aren't meeting certain standards.
That's interesting. Some others have. Yes.
I think, too, we need to realize that the public schools have not only changed in maybe outlook and other things, but the public schools have changed in their purpose. In my own family, my father went to the 8th grade. That was it. My mother went to the 5th. That was it. Nothing more was expected. After all, we just got up and got married anyway and didn't need education. Now, we are mandated, at least in the state of Washington, to educate every child. That includes autistic children, that includes mentally retarded children, that includes physically and mentally handicapped children of all, you know, ranges of those categories. And I think to compare the public schools to 50 years ago and say, over the hill, they learned something in, you can't compare. It's like comparing apples and oranges and trying to make them the same thing. There's just a difference in what is expected of a public school and what is expected out of the teachers in public schools today. Because even though there are private programs for some of these people, very often they're mainstreamed into a classroom and the teacher must, you know, work with a much wider variety of child than schools did 30, 40, 50 years ago. And so I think we need to keep that in mind. Especially when I get uptight when they start complaining about how the test scores have dropped. Forgetting that now, you know, in the school where I am, one-fifth of the population are Vietnamese, Cambodian, Laotians, who are English is their second language, and they're just beginning to learn. Well, you get their test scores in with the others, and you're not going to have the kind of test scores you had if they were all the same, you know, maybe they're just kindergarten or whatever. And I get really uptight.
No, we have, again, my main thesis here is that, well, I'm an advocate of a public place for people to come together, and I think the school is one place. My main thesis is that we've over-expected, and therefore we have somehow expected public school to automatically solve our problems. You've raised two more. I had one section in this paper on special education, and certainly with handicapped and now with gifted children, and of all of those expectations, which again deal with differences. And the other issue you raise is English as a second language. And again, our country must deal with, well, the whole things before the legislature now about illegal aliens. And often that question again gets focused in the school, particularly in our border community, South Texas. Should these children be allowed to come to school or not? Most of them are in school. And that's a good thing. So again, the school gets to be the center focus of questions that our country must deal with. Some other thoughts? What should we do? What basket should we put our eggs? Should we put our eggs all in the same basket? What, some of you have raised, what should be the Christian stance in this? Again, it bodes back to what we've been saying all week. In fact, yesterday, some of you were at our meeting, we talked about five responses of Niebuhr to American civil religion. Let me just go over those. One is Christ against culture, flee, be separate from. Culture will contaminate us. And some of the answers people pose to the questions in the public school are that one. I will educate my children at home, and I don't even want them to see TV, movies, whatever. Another is Christ in culture. Somehow it's all the same. No, we fit comfortably in the culture. My kids can good training at church and good training at school, and it's somehow all the same thing. Another is Christ above culture. Yes, we should work in the public sphere. We should kind of be the good example there, the Christ above culture. The fourth of Niebuhr's is Christ in culture in paradox. And that's where I think, as a Lutheran stance, that's where we are. Seeing the struggle and jumping right in and knowing the problems, knowing we're part of the problem, and working by the power of God's grace to somehow keep at it, to hang in there, as you say. And the fifth is Christ, the transformer of culture. and that is that somehow the church can change society. And there are varieties of ways that people try to do that. So one's faith, one's Christian stance in relationship to culture, I think, determines in some ways our approach to public education. What should we do? Where, you know, what do you think? I probably showed my hand too much, but feel free to disagree.
I'm not sure how long that is, but have you seen that document that's going to come before the convention in October regarding...
Which convention?
The
ALC, okay.
In support of Lutheran Day School?
I have not seen the document. I've been part of some of the debate before, but have you seen the document?
No, I was just wondering if you had, and that's going to be interesting, because it's going to include, I guess, what I've heard, it's going to include a support piece on public education. But that's kind of by the way. The thrust of it is that they're going to ask the American Lutheran Church to, for the first time, to come out in favor of the private school alternative within the American Lutheran Church.
I come out of Missouri Synod. I'm now an ALC pastor, and I served in New England, an LCA church, because that's what you've got out in New England. So I feel kind of pan-Lutheran here. And therefore, I've looked at parochial schools through the eyes of these various church bodies. And it's interesting, in the American Lutheran Church, some of you are not American Lutheran Church members, we had two boards or two agencies of the church, in a sense, debating the purpose of the parochial school about a year ago. One saying that the Lutheran school was not particularly a mission agency, and another saying, yes, wait a minute, it really is. And so it will be interesting now to see this document. I haven't seen it yet. Those in favor have said, look at where in the American Lutheran Church, which has a relatively small number of Lutheran schools, quite a few of which are on the West Coast, incidentally, are saying that look at those schools and look at the kinds of people in them. We have a broader spectrum of people. We have a lot of non-church people, non-Lutheran ethnic background people. We have multiracial situations. Indeed, it is a mission agency. And others saying, no, that's not the way to go. How is it with the LCA? They have some Lutheran schools, not a high number. Okay. What's your stance or your congregation's stance?
It's a mission to the community.
Okay. How so? What kind of mission?
Let's see. Christian, and only 10% of our congregation uses the church. And the rest of it is what?
Of the school, you mean?
Of the school.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. And the rest are from outside, of which probably there are a few that don't have a church there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Some of our Lutheran bodies have said, let's put our energy into church college systems, and have gone that route. Others are saying, and a growing number today say, no, nursery school level. Let's go that way. And certainly Missouri Synod's heritage was the day school up through eighth grade and later the high school, and saying that's where. So those raise questions, developmental questions of the child, you know, formative times, and what is where should you have specifically a Christian context all day long? You know, where is that most important? Certainly Lutherans have, I don't hear Lutherans publicly saying, maybe sometimes we think that in our fear, I don't hear Lutherans saying we want a separatist kind of thing. They're saying what is the best way, what's the best way to have a form of Christians so that they can live in the world.
But the Missouri Synod system was created on precisely the same kind of premises that the Roman Catholic system was created. It was a shelter.
It was a German school.
A German school, a shelter school. It was strictly a parochial school.
It was. And the German language began to disappear from the schools and the churches of Missouri Synod at the time of the World Wars. So sometimes society helps us make decisions.
but they were still perceived as schools of the congregation, by and for the congregation, whereas the schools of the American Lutheran Church are seen almost exclusively as mission schools.
And partly that is, I think, what you're saying, all right? Is the time in which they came into being. I mean, this is schools that came into being in the 1970s, that came into being in the 1920s, were a different kind of you know, different kind of place.
Sure, and the PR material that our school puts out says this kind of thing. It says, we can do in the Christian day school what the public school is incapable of doing. We can teach Christ, we can teach from a Christian point of view, and that's what the public school simply cannot do. Now, you can argue that whether it's necessary, but that's why they exist.
Yeah, and that is true. And then you ask the next question, and then for what end are you planning to do that? For what end are you planning to do that? Some of you, yeah, go ahead.
Have there ever been any studies done of Lutherans in terms of...
A little louder.
Busing, and during that time, whether they were just as much in the mainstream of other white Christians who were trying to get away from black folks.
You hear a question? Had there been any studies done during the time of flight from the public school over racial issues? Were Lutherans fleeing as quickly as anyone else? I can say from our experience in Detroit, interesting, again, how things work. We came, a very German Lutheran church, who'd always had a parochial school. You're supposed to have a parochial school. They'd grown up, commitment to a parochial school. So even when their kids were gone, there was just a handful. I mean, literally, after a church of 2,000-3,000 members, down to a handful of old white people, 65, 70, they still had a full Lutheran school. I don't know how they paid for it, but they did. All full of black kids. That somehow, because their commitment to having a parochial school had led them into mission, that they might not have even thought about their dedication and their loyalty preceded their thought about mission. Well, of course, we should have a parochial school. That there are kids here to come, fine. So it's interesting somehow how God uses us, you know, in spite of ourselves. But I don't know, and that's an important question to ask.
Well, you know, maybe you know, that the ALC service agency for its schools said that any school that was determined to be a white flight school during the 70s was kicked out of the association.
No, I think that, I feel at least, that Lutherans have been trying to ask that question very well. And they're very aware of a lot of, quote, Christian schools coming up when they had Lutheran schools already and saying, we don't want to be in that bag. What I'm saying is I think we have to keep asking the hard questions.